Video program Reveal explores the controversial adoption of a Northern Cheyenne child by a wealthy white family in Utah. Co-reporter Bernice Yearn says the saga started in 2017 when David Levitt, the politically connected brother of Utah's former governor Mike Levitt, traveled to the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Montana. A Native woman with connections to his wife's family was struggling and had a young child. Levitt thought he could help through adoption.
In that whole process, members of the child's Native family have raised concerns and have objected to the adoption. The story really looks at how well the Indian Child Welfare Act was followed.
The act is intended to keep Native families together, but relatives say after the mother was arrested and the child put in the care of the BIA, Levitts became a temporary guardian. Weeks later, the Levitts adopted the child against the wishes of the biological father and other Native relatives.
Another important aspect of this is the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Indian Student Placement Program. It's now a defunct program, but for nearly 50 years, students were taken from the reservation and placed in LDS family foster homes. And the aim was to educate children, but also, of course, assimilation and baptism.
The Reveal episode drops this Saturday. I'm Brian Bull from Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 22nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff, Eric Galatis, and Mark Moran. The producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Senator Ron Wyden, Public News Service, and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Have a great night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
My name is Heather. I live in the Falcon Arts Building in the Humboldt neighborhood of the historic Albina District in Portland, Oregon.
Well, I understand that you are helping to organize an event that's coming up, the Albina Neighbors Block Party on Sunday, August 25th. What can you tell me about this event?
Yeah, so it's going to be a free community event. It is family friendly. We are going to have performers, vendors, artists, a bunch of interactive art projects for folks to come and paint elements on the land. We will be having Mike Crenshaw perform, which we're super excited about. And we're centering BIPOC artists in the neighborhood. Yeah, it's shaping up to be a great day. We're hoping that the event will raise awareness about this piece of land in the neighborhood so that we can get it into the hands of the community and see a better outcome for it than more unaffordable housing.
Who all are you hoping attends this block party?
Really, anybody in the Albina District, anybody in the Humboldt neighborhood. We'd love folks to come out and kind of imagine what could possibly be on this land. And so having the opportunity to connect, to do art, to, you know, get to know folks in the neighborhood, that's what we're hoping will happen. And what we're hoping to hear from folks is, you know, what their thoughts are about what we could potentially do with the land that would be of greatest benefit to the community.
Can you give me some background on this piece of land that the block party is going to be taking place on?
Yeah, totally. So this land is in Humboldt. It's within the Albina District. And as most folks probably know, this district has experienced and continues to experience the impacts of racist policies like redlining and gentrification, whitewashing of the black history that flourished in this district for decades. Once a bustling black arts and business district, this is a really interesting statistic. By the 1960s, 4 out of 5 black Portlanders lived in the Albina District, but now only 1 in 5 do. And that's coming from research that the PSU Population Research Center did. So basically, the black population in Albina went from 70% to 30% in less than 2 decades as a direct result of the impacts of these racist policies. So what we're hoping is that you know, what happens next on this space isn't for gentrification, isn't further building of unaffordable housing, which is what has been proposed. We'd really love to partner with some Black-led organizations in the area to figure out a better use for the land.
Are there preliminary ideas of what that might look like?
You know, those of us who are living in the Falcon don't necessarily want to be the ones and don't feel like we're the right ones to make the decision. We really want to hear from the community. But right now, what we have going on in the land is a bit of a community garden and a gathering space. Of course, those of us living here would love to continue to see green space. We in Humboldt have, I think, the least green space of any neighborhood in Portland. So there's an interest in keeping access to green space and community gathering space. But, you know, as we begin to partner with Black-led organizations in the area, we're hearing there really is a need for low-income housing for families. Maybe there's some interest in a museum showcasing Black Portlanders' art. So, yeah, lots of different ideas. Maybe even, you know, some farming or agricultural opportunities could be a possibility.
So coming back to the block party that is taking place on this plot of land, what do you hope folks get out of this event?
We really just want folks to feel connected to community and to the land. There's a lot of free things that will be there, right? So we're going to be having Greater Good Northwest will be coming out with bags of produce that they've been growing. There's a lot of local pizzerias that have donated so that folks can get fed. We'll have a lot of community resources, and we really want folks to connect with one another and also to imagine what possibilities could be on this land and basically just have a good old time.
And what's the status of the plot of land right now?
So this plot has been sold two times. It was sold by the owner of our building to a development company back in 2019, and then we were successfully able to stop that development proposal. But unfortunately, instead of ceding that land to the community as we had hoped, they just sold it again to another development company. So that development company is Seneca, and they own it today. They have made a proposal for more unaffordable housing. We have kind of risen up as a community to voice our concerns that this isn't what the community needs. And right now, we're kind of in a holding pattern, waiting to see what's next. But in the meantime, we're really hoping to figure out, you know, what could that partnership look like so that we could potentially come to the developer and make an offer.
And is that something that you're looking for more community participation in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this event, which, by the way, I definitely want to give a shout out and a plug to Northeast Coalition of Neighbors. They provided us a small grant in order to allow us to host this event and do some beautification on the land. We're hoping to hear from folks at the event, but also to start to build the connections and the community partnerships that could lead to a lasting solution for the land so that we aren't continually fighting off development attempts.
If our listeners want more info either on the project that you're talking about or about the block party this weekend, where should they look?
Our Instagram is Albina Neighbors, and you can also reach us by email at albinaneighbors@gmail.com.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I just hope everybody can come out and enjoy the space, enjoy the community connection and all of the offerings. We're going to have some great performers, not only Mike Crenshaw that I mentioned, but we'll have Johnny Cool DJing, as well as a bunch of vendors that are selling jewelry and art and music. Again, we'll have these interactive opportunities for kids and anybody in the community who wants to paint. We'll be painting elements on the land, putting together a community mural, and doing art that indicates for folks that there'll be an opportunity for folks to actually write down, you know, what they see that could be a potential, what could they dream up on the land. So hope to see you guys there.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Althea.
That was Heather from Albina Neighbors speaking with me about the Albina Neighbors Block Party that is happening on Sunday, August 25th from 1 to 4 p.m. at 5422 Mississippi Avenue at the green space behind the Falcon Arts Building. For KABU, I'm Althea Billings.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community. We'll be right back.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Today I'm speaking with Laura Grimes, Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, about an opinion piece she published this month. It's called "The Arts Community Has a Lot at Stake in the Election That Will Reshape Portland City Hall." We discussed all that and more. Let's go to Laura. Thank you for being here. We're going to be talking about an opinion piece you published this month. What can you tell me about this piece and the thinking that went into it?
Yeah, so the general election coming up in November will have an opportunity to completely reshape City Hall in that the City Council will grow from what is now 5 members, 4 commissioners and the mayor, to 12 members. So there will be 3 representatives from 4 different districts, and the mayor will now work with the city administrator and not be part of the council. But also, because 4 of the city commissioners, out of 4 of them, 3 of them are running for mayor, and 1 of them is running for a new council seat. So it means a whole new leadership will take over City Hall. And they're thinking that maybe they don't have a background about the impact that the arts have on the city. So a group of arts leaders across the state, across the city, has come together to sort of put together information to help inform a lot of these new leaders who will take charge of the city in January.
Can you give me a little bit of the structure of how the arts community and the government interact in the current day and how you might expect that to change coming in 2025?
A lot of the arts community in the city is in flux right now because the Regional Arts and Culture Council oversees the Tri-County area, which is Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. And the city had been funding a large portion of the operating costs of RAC, like more than 80%. A year ago, the city said that it was not going to continue funding RAC. And RAC had been established in 1995, so it meant that what they offered the rest of the arts community was going to be severely diminished. That funding ended in June of this year, and now RAC has sized down its staff, and the city has decided that it will now decide how it's going to allocate funding to arts groups. It has set up some new granting structures that are going to be taking effect. Mm-hmm. And RAC will be able to continue to distribute some small grants at one time. But I know that RAC is now having conversations about what its future role will be. It had been supporting the whole Tri-County area, but now it's looking that maybe it won't distribute grants anymore. And where should its focus be now? So it is in flux. At the same time, the city adopted in May a new cultural plan for the future called Our Creative Future, which had been in the process for a couple of years. It involved a lot of listening sessions throughout the Tri-County area. It had been led by the city, although it is somewhat endorsed by several of the other governments around the region. It has a whole new plan to help to guide the future. So it's kind of depends on how much of the new city council leaders know about this plan and know how that's going to relate to all of the arts groups. The arts groups have a huge impact on the economy, on revitalization, on enhancing the city. It has an identity as being known as a creative city. It's a key part of our brand. So how does that look going forward, and how much the arts community is going to be engaged with these leaders is still a big question mark.
I want to address that point directly because there's so much talk about, oh, we need to revitalize Portland. We need to revitalize downtown. And the arts community and that reputation and venues are such a big part of that. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, so also a lot of the venues are in flux right now. The Keller Auditorium needs to have earthquake enhancements made. And it's possible that it could take up to 2 years to renovate it. And if that happens, that means that it would shut down for the Broadway shows that come through town, which support more than 50% of the rest of the Portland 5 venues. Out of those 5, it supports 50% of that. So it's a huge economic chunk to support the rest of those areas. Also, a lot of people work in the Keller Auditorium, and it's an important piece of people's, you know, livelihood. So if that were to shut down for 2 years, that's huge. Also, when you shut down a venue, it means a change in audience behavior. Do they adopt those habits again? You have to build up those habits again to be able to come back. At the same time, it also means that Portland Opera and Oregon Ballet Theater would have to find someplace else to perform. It would displace them. What would happen? What can they do? How they now perform in big halls and they have big audiences. It would mean a huge reduction in their audiences and revenue. So it has a huge impact. A couple of other proposals have been floated, one at Lloyd Center and one at Portland State University, which and the one at Portland State University looks especially promising because they have planned for both a bigger hall, similar in size to the Keller Auditorium, and a smaller venue, about a 1,200-seat performing arts space. And they're looking at a hotel space. So it's 5 blocks from where Keller is now. There's also a whole push to renovate Keller Hall because it has a historical significance with the fountain across the street. So there's a big push for that. So the city is supposed to decide on what's happening with the Keller, and they have now pushed back the decision to October. They were supposed to decide in August, and now they have pushed it back again. So what the plan is there is still up in the air. The debate about what's happening with the Keller has been loud and divisive. So there's a lot at stake there.
I want to ask briefly about RAC, because when this sort of refusal of funds, and before sort of the new structure of how Portland was going to do it was fully shaken out, I had talked to people about it, and somebody brought up the concern about having, you know, arts and arts funding too closely tied to city government, or city government having influence over those kinds of things. I guess I'm curious about the history of, like, the structure of RAC, and is it the case that people feel that that structure really worked quite well? And are there, you know, I don't know, challenges that you foresee with the new system?
So there is a concern that arts funding could be at the whim of leadership in City Hall. It's important that it is separate, and that it has strong ongoing resources that support both RAC and the whole community. It's the new city structure, though, is supposed to have an administrator. So there's hope that there will be a continuity, and not just as leadership changes, that there will be a functioning government that continues. That is sort of the why it's changing, that it's finally getting a structure of government that supports a city of its size. And with RAC founded in 1995 to support the Tri-County area, there was that infrastructure is important, and because the arts do need a broad regional approach, not just the city. A lot of activity happens in the outlying areas. RAC, it's important to understand sort of the history that RAC has been a guiding ship for the arts community. And in that it being strong means that the arts community has been able to be strong. They had a huge shift in January of 2020 when they laid off a number of their staff and they eliminated the Right Brain Initiative, which had been supporting arts programs in schools. And it was the middle of the school year. It often supported arts programs in schools that were Title I schools, that were in areas that were economically not strong. And so they also had a lot of students that were from immigrant communities that spoke English as a second language. It's probably safe to say that some of them did not come, had some lack of stability. So to pull a program in these schools at such a time seemed to add an extra burden on these schools. That program has now been taken over by another nonprofit, fortunately. But the whole history of RAC there, at that point, it's important to understand that RAC seemed to stumble then. And if it's not a strong guiding ship for the rest of the community, then we lack that North Star in a way. And when RAC, when that happened in January of 2020, what that meant is that for organizations that look to RAC for their organizational development, they take classes there, they seek advice, and if RAC looks like it's not strong to be able to offer training to help strengthen organizations, then it loses its image to be able to support everybody else. So now it's rethinking that. RAC traditionally with the funding had been, I know that people had different views of how that funding worked. Some thought that they started to change their model some and not support the big organizations quite as much. They wanted to spread it out and be more diverse and inclusive of its funding. But it meant losing a lot of funds to the big organizations, which is the Portland Art Museum, the Portland Opera, Oregon Ballet Theater, Portland Center Stage. So it was a huge hit to those organizations, but it also meant that funding now could filter out and support up and coming, you know, and organizations that hadn't been funded in the fat past. That structure is changing, and RAC now needs to rethink what it's going to be doing.
Where do you see there being opportunity with the new government system and engaging with new leaders?
That's a great question. I see that there's a lot of opportunity with the new cultural plan that's in place, the Our Creative Future plan. It is a nice sort of guideline. It's important that it's had a lot of input from a lot of people. So I think there's been a lot of inclusivity in developing that plan. So I would like to see that the leaders carefully look at that. I think that it's important too to recognize that the revitalization downtown, it's not just downtown. It filters out into all the neighborhoods as well. There's a lot of vitality in Portland neighborhoods. There's a concern that if we just look at downtown, if we just look at ways that it can be revitalized, that all the exciting, vibrant activity that's happening in the neighborhoods might be overlooked. So I think that's a key piece to engage with and figure out how to support the whole ecosystem. There's another sort of way of thinking that sometimes it means just supporting the larger arts institutions, which are all located downtown. And it's important that they are economically strong because they do support the smaller institutions. The whole economic ecosystem is important and vital. But that's also not where everything happens. So it's important to have a bigger picture of the entire arts community, that it's big and small, that it's downtown and elsewhere, that there's a broad geographic location, and that it's all forms of arts. It's performing arts, it's dance, it's music, it's visual arts, it's galleries, it's a cultural activity, it's KBOO radio, it's all of the things that go into making the city vibrant and engaging.
So there's also this proposal to merge the existing Portland Arts Tax with a tax to fund Portland parks. What do you think about that?
So there's talk of marrying arts funding with the parks funding, city parks funding. And some people are really hopeful that maybe that will offer a steady support of funding for the arts. And at the same time, because the city has had an arts tax, which has put together a steady funding, but the arts tax has always been controversial. It's considered a regressive tax because it's the same amount for everybody. It doesn't allow for different income levels. If you make at least $1,000, you pay $35 for this tax. And it has always had its own mechanism to take in that money, separate from just how it's lumped in with property taxes or how people are taxed through their paychecks or whatever. So it's been this whole separate funding mechanism, which has been supportive of the arts, but it's also fixed. And so there is excitement about the arts being lumped in with the parks, in that it would automatically have support and voter approval. The arts don't have to fight for themselves. Everybody loves parks. But at the same time, it's up to voter approval. And so Portland's voters have historically been very supportive of levies for libraries, schools, parks. So, but you know, you could be subjected to any type of change in audience thinking or behavior, or if voters decide that they don't want to approve it, there goes that steady form of funding. So right now, the arts tax, $35, as such as it is already built into the system, and it doesn't go away. It's not at the whim of voters, but on the other hand, it could be that we get an influx of cash as long as the voters continue to like it and continue to approve it.
What are the takeaways that you hope folks get from this opinion piece that you wrote and thinking about arts going into this election?
That's a good question. So this consortium or group of arts leaders have developed a brief that, and we have partnered with this group of leaders to publish the brief. They have sent it to current members of City Hall and to candidates coming up to help to inform them. And we have partnered with this group to publish it and so that it's made public for anybody to look at. And I think it's important to educate people about the role of the arts, that it plays a huge part in the city economy. There's a study that I cite in the story, Americans for the Arts, that arts groups throughout the city participated in. And according to this study, Portland nonprofit groups generate at least $405 million in economic revenue. And that is nearly half for the whole state. And granted, that's just nonprofit groups. That's not for profit. The whole creative economy includes the film industry, includes advertising agencies, includes designers, architects. So it's a much bigger economic impact. From this study, I guess only about a third of nonprofits responded to it. So you can imagine that the impact is actually much bigger. I would also say, too, that RAC helped to promote that study and encourage people to participate. So that advocacy piece that they play is huge in the region. And it's needed for that cohesiveness for everybody to come together. We can't advocate for ourselves if we don't have this kind of information readily available. So I would hope that this piece would educate the public at large and candidates about the role that the arts play, that it has a huge economic impact, that there's a lot at stake. There's a lot in flux right now in the arts community. We're kind of waiting to see how things play out. But there's also a lot of support that needs to happen so that arts groups can come back as they were before the pandemic, so that they can be stronger and more resilient and add to the vibrancy of the city. The brief that this arts group developed also, it's actually very worthwhile to indicate just the value of the arts, what it brings. There's the social impact, there's the mental health impact, behavioral impact. It helps people to learn. It helps kids to learn. It helps them to stay in school. There's just an enormous impact that the arts have in developing the social fabric of our city. And that's what I would hope that people would get out of it.
If our listeners are interested in reading it for themselves or learning more about Oregon Arts Watch, where can they do that?
You can find us at orartswatch.org. We have a lot of stories about the arts. We do arts journalism that is available online. And the whole election topic is available. We have ads on the site that you can click to so that you can read the brief, and then we'll have all of the feedback from the candidates available to read their views on the arts. orartswatch.org.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Oregon Arts Watch Executive Director Laura Grimes speaking with me about an opinion piece published this month. It's called "The Arts Community Has a Lot at Stake in the Election That Will Reshape Portland City Hall. With many new faces taking the helm, arts leaders make a case for why culture plays a significant role in the city's economy." More information